Welcome to Popcast Deluxe. Had to make another show. I'm getting claustrophobic. Of Weekly Cultural Review. I'm John Caramonica, a critic at the New York Times.
I'm Joe Coscarelli, a reporter at the New York Times.
Before we get into the big conversation this week, there's a subscribe button. I think there's even a QR code.
Sure.
Like, why not? Like, I mean, I haven't quite figured out how you can, like, be looking at it on your phone, but also scanning it with your phone. But if you're looking at it on
experience.
It is a two-screen experience. You know, if you're, like, following up from the Mr. Beast video on your home TV, and then you can go to the deluxe. Anyway, like and subscribe, youtube.com/podcast. Bing, bing. Joe, what makes a great album great? I have some thoughts on that this week.
Okay.
I also have some thoughts on what other people think makes a great album great.
Right.
They are not the same as what I think. I want to talk about that in regards to two albums. So obviously, here we are in the light, the bold light of Cowboy Carter,
the
second act of the Beyoncé trilogy that came out on Friday. Also, genre sad boy.
Yes. We will be going very deep on the Trippy Red Machine Gun Kelly collab album.
As a literal total sidebar, you saw the whole thing on Twitter with the producer. But then it was like maybe fake. Yeah. I don't know. You saw the fake, like the press release or like the TikTok.
Good
with
memes
the
all around.
Really, really solid. If that was a marketing strategy, like genuinely really good.
Beautiful.
Like actually like give that person a raise.
Yep.
If you are that person,
yep,
send us an email.
Yep.
Podcast.
And if it was just marketing for the producer themselves.
Also like, great.
Great.
Yep. Also great. Every part of it. Great.
Yep.
We're not going to be talking tragically about genre sad boy today, but maybe in another time. So we're talking about Cowboy Carter. I also want to talk about the Future and Metro Boomin album, We Don't Trust You. Okay. These are two albums where there is the quality of the music and then there is the discourse about the music.
Oh, yeah.
And obviously, we live in an era of extremely robust meta-narratives about culture.
If you're lucky, especially.
Yes. I mean, that is the goal, in a sense, is to have as robust a meta-narrative as possible on top of the music. I think something that we've talked about a lot, and I think which comes up a lot in how criticism has evolved, is often people mistake the volume, intensity, and depth of meta-narrative for the quality of the product itself, of the music itself. And I think we both have strong feelings about that. And so for both of these albums, obviously I want to talk about music, but I also want to talk about how people talk about these records. I mean, in a sense, I want to fall victim to the same thing that these folks are falling victim to.
Sure.
But
meta, we're gonna pull back one more layer.
That is correct.
Yeah.
So let's start with Beyoncé. What should we play?
Let's play the electric sitar on American Requiem, the first track.
Sure.
And then let's talk about whether the double I for Act Two and all the song titles is just an I or it means two, because it's both and it's
both.
Confusing.
It's both.
Do you feel me? Taking up space.
It's a lot happening on this.
Is Jon Batiste rocking the sitar?
I'm gonna have to assume yes.
You think his hands are on the whatever that instrument is? I want to see what, like, sounds great.
But is it an actual or is it a digital? Is it like Andre 3000 with the electric wind instrument, the Yui?
I'm going to go ahead and say it is real because I thought, and we'll get to this.
I thought the opposite.
No, we'll get to this. But in the press release for Cowboy Carter, which is the text of this, this is the most Beyoncé has spoken about her music
in like years, 5 years. Yeah.
In the giant press release that came with this album. And she says specifically that this album is a reaction to AI. and that she wanted to return to real instruments because of the rise of artificial intelligence.
Yes.
So I'm going to go ahead and say
it's a real instrument.
It's a real instrument.
And I'm going to go ahead and say that real instruments include digital instruments. Respectfully.
Yes.
This is, man, where do we start with this record? Cowboy Carter was advertised as a country record, or indicated, advertised maybe too strong a word.
Sure.
It was nodded to that it was a country record. And I wrote this piece last week about how that's a bit of a red herring and it kind of doesn't matter. And also when people hear country, they think mainstream. They're thinking Luke Combs and Morgan Wallen. They're thinking mainstream Nashville. And it turned out that from a discursive approach, that was actually quite a smart strategy to roll out this album.
Yeah.
To say it's country, which immediately puts it in a lineage of Black participants in a genre that has historically excluded them. It automatically sets up a political valence for the album and a kind of cultural power of Beyoncé is coming to reclaim Black narratives in country music.
And also an antagonist, like the whole thing with the radio station, not wanting to play the singles, which were the which are really the most country songs on the album in a lot of ways. 16 Carriages,
also just Hold'em. All red herrings, like all fake. Imagine being the person who emailed the random country station in Oklahoma.
Sure.
And just be like, why are you not Black? Yeah. And literally that poor guy just being like, I didn't know there was a Beyonce. I'm sorry. We're an independent station. Like, please, please don't yell at me.
This is the most emails I've ever gotten in my life.
Yeah. Let's just save that energy for iHeart. Save it for the elections, you know?
Like, right. But then she comes out and says, it's not a country album. It's a Beyonce album.
Which is true.
That was like the second shoe.
It is true.
It's true. And then she's like, haha, gotcha. This album is about genre, sad boy genre. Just genre.
This album is about Machine Gun Kelly.
Although it sort of is about Machine Gun Kelly. We're gonna get to the Post Malone part.
Oh my gosh. So it's about genre. It's okay. So having listened to this album a few times now, I was really trying to think hard about why an artist of Beyonce stature is making an album that sounds like this. And the thing that it sounds
like. And this.
Yes. And what it reminds me is obviously, like, are there country or roots music referent points and antecedents? Like, absolutely. But especially once you get into, like, the midpoint towards, like, the three, like, from, like, the 30% mark to, like, the 80%
really
mark.
Really long album.
Incredibly long. What it reminded me of is actually 1970s singer-songwriter, like folk or roots adjacent music. It's auteur. It's like folk auteur music. Mm-hmm. It's not a country record. It's a folk auteur record.
It's
and
roots. It's about ambient. Roots, it's about all genre.
Yeah. And obviously these songs are rendered with like some modern twists, some songs more than others. It's also a bit of a chaotic record. It does not land on a style, like on a firm style. Like if you look at Renaissance, I know like I like Renaissance a little bit more than you, but the one thing that I think you can say about Renaissance is it's fundamentally devoted to a style.
Though it also spans a lot of
subversions of that style, but it does tell one bigger umbrella story about Black dance music.
Yes.
This album does not do that. And it's interesting because I think it feels like it's doing that with all the little interludes, the Willie Nelson, the Dolly Parton, the Linda Martell. Like, I think it feels like it's trying to stitch together a narrative with loud parts that are screen grabbable. But I don't actually think as an album that it's telling that story front to back. I think if I had to guess, a lot of these songs, you know, we've talked about this previously. Beyonce doesn't work on a song for 20 minutes and put it out. Some stuff's been sitting around. Some stuff's recent. Some stuff's been sitting around and then changed more recently. I think there are a number of songs that fit into the kind of like singer, songwriter, whatever, bigger umbrella, which of course, singer-songwriter music classically is like one person making one set of lyrics.
Which is interesting in the Beyonce universe.
And in the Beyonce universe, that's not what this is. Like, it's funny. Do you see the tweet that like one of the interesting kind of like head fakes about how Beyonce makes music is there are so many component parts that you're sort of obliged to think of her as an auteur.
Yeah, I think this was Louis from
Pop. I think it's Louis. Yes.
Shout out to Louis.
Which I think is fundamentally correct. And I think, you know, Beyonce is like the lead orchestrator of all these ideas, is what we've been seeing and hearing from her for the last, certainly the last like 5 years, six years.
I'd say a decade.
Yeah, that's probably right. Yeah, that's probably right. And so also in the piece that I wrote, there is this, I mentioned this, and there is this transition for Beyonce. And I think it's roughly around the same time, hitmaker to conversation starter.
Sure.
Now, if you are making an album with the express goal of starting conversations,
then this is the best album ever.
I have seen that take.
If that's your goal, I'm saying if that is the goal.
I have seen that opinion expressed for that reason on the internet.
There's the most footnotes, reference points.
Yes.
Allusions, samples, collaborators.
Yeah. Can I just read something? I mean, it's from the Wikipedia page, but it's an easy credits thing.
Is it from the impact section?
It's not from the impact
section. You saw that there was an impact section immediately, and the first line was, this album has had impact.
I did not know.
That's a good summary of where you're going with this conversation, which is like, if this album exists to have impact, it immediately
has impact. Self-fulfilling prophecy. Yes. So samples and interpolations. You have Blackbird by the Beatles. You have a Sun House record, Chuck Berry. You have Linda Martell. You have Fleetwood Mac, Stevie Nicks. You have Lee Hazlewood, Nancy Sinatra. You've got the Beach Boys. Underworld?
Yeah, there's an Underworld sample.
That probably should have been on the last record. But anyway, Patsy Cline. You know,
sure.
It's a and number on and of on things. And on. Yeah. Yes, and I think when I say screen grabbable, what I really mean is digestible in small parts. And I think what's happened and happens in this record and happens in a lot of records and also happens on some level with the future records we'll get to.
Love that. Yeah, but it's true.
But it's true.
We're going to talk about Rodney O.
It's yes, absolutely. But people, especially I want to say younger listeners, say, oh, Beyonce covered the Beatles. That's inherently interesting.
And then?
And
then you open the Wikipedia and you get the next slide.
Yes. And so that's inherently interesting. And I also think one of the struggles, and look, with these samples, for example, this is where I become an old person, right? Like, I'm old enough to remember when the act of sampling was inherently radical. Just very simply, unlicensed sampling was inherently radical. I'm also old enough to remember when the deliberate deployment of an unexpected or perhaps counterintuitive sample felt raw and also embedded into a narrative. But that was 35 years ago. And this is a long time. And so for me, at least as a listener, sampling a well-known old record is not that exciting.
Even if you're going to flip it in some
way. Doesn't really matter. You want to talk
about Caribou doing Manny Fresh? This is a big conversation piece.
Yes.
Over the weekend.
That was, and also, or even a different kind of sample, like whatever Sexy Red is doing in her video, which is basically just like an era sample.
Yeah, just putting Fabo in there.
Yeah, it's great. Fabo, we love you. So to me, I think a lot of the conversation about this record gets lost. And I sometimes find this, like, I did not review this record. But I find this a challenge sometimes when I'm reviewing an album like this, where I feel like I have to mention all the things.
Every single Easter egg.
Yes, because I know everybody on the internet will say, why didn't you mention this Easter egg? Wouldn't that change your whole approach? It's actually, no, it won't change my whole approach, because as a critic, I try to take a slightly more holistic, distanced
It's not listen. All data points.
Yeah, but I think because an album like this has so many data points, I mean, in an earlier episode, we talked about when you're rolling out, you have to have like 1,000 touch points or 1,000 points of light. You have to have 1,000 touch points. This album is like, I got your 1,000 touch points. Yeah. And so people will be talking about those touch points and not really talking about, do the songs work?
Exactly. And I do think, you know, I had a little bit of this with Renaissance and I have it more here. Like, Beyonce has really gone from under-explaining, arguably, to over-explaining.
Yeah.
And a lot of the references you're talking about are not even woven into the music, but they're in these interludes. You have the Willie Nelson, you have literally a radio dial flipping through the history of genre.
And literally, like, every, like, Americana artist who's ever done that is like, why doesn't anyone care when I do this?
And then you have Linda Martell, a historical figure in her own right. I'm sure her Wikipedia got a mad hits over the weekend.
Sure.
Saying, like, genre is a tricky concept. You know, there's a lot of literal explaining in this. And then in the lyrics, so, you know, we started with American Requiem. That's the first line of the album. There's a lot of talking going on. You know, the last part of that song where she explains, you know, they said I was too country. Now they say I'm not country enough. Mm-hmm. Again, that's the fundamental tension in country music throughout its whole history. Too country, not country enough. Mm-hmm. Talked about it with Jelly Roll. We talked about it with every country artist. I highly recommend Major Labels, a book about genre, if you care about this. It sounds like Beyonce might have dipped into this book.
Mm-hmm.
Someone should buy it for her if she has it. It's like it's very much about this project and what these barriers mean and don't mean and how people self-identify.
I also just want to add one additional tweak to the country framing, which is, and I in the piece that I wrote, and I think even in the piece that Cesario wrote about country radio, it's like we're thinking about country as a sound versus country as a business, and like, what are you doing? Sure. What are you participating in? And like, the contention being that country as a sound is where she's trying to live versus country as a business, which is fine. And I think probably the right approach. But there's a third thing that I think probably should be leaned in on, which is country as a mode of being. Mm. And I think when Beyonce is saying they said I was too country, I think what she's talking about is the 90s and being like an R&B singer with a clear Southern accent. And in her phrasing, like, much more influenced by what we would think of as Southern soul than, like, say, Motown or whatnot.
So that's on this album, too.
Yes. I mean, we're living 20 years after that. But I think if you think of early reads on Beyonce solo and also Destiny's Child, that's a third kind of country. And I feel like I'm actually sort of intrigued. I wish I was hearing more about that and the lineage of music that she's making here connected to the late 90s and the 2000s.
What's interesting to me, and, you know, it's funny, Beyonce said that every song on this album is a reference to, like, a Western that they were playing on TV. You know, and one of the ones she listed was Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yes.
And I feel like there's my criticism of that movie of Martin Scorsese is, like, he's like, all right, people haven't got the subtleties of my work. Like, here, fine. These guys are bad.
Yes.
And Beyonce maybe is suffering from the same thing. You know, she talks about losing album of the year. We had the Jay-Z speech at the Grammys.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to embarrass this young lady, but she has more Grammys than everyone and never won album of the year. So even by your own metrics, that doesn't work. Think about that. The most Grammys, never won album of the year. That doesn't work.
She's like, all right, it was Daddy Lessons, too subtle. Coachella, where I'm going to weave all this black music in so artfully, every not a wasted second. You know, I'm going to do this lineage through the black marching band tradition. Mm-hmm. Like, that go over people's heads? I don't know, you know? So she's like, all right, fine. Like, I'm really, really, really going to spell it out for you guys. And that's how you end up with Blackbird, a Beatles cover, the second song on a Beyonce album featuring black country artists.
Blackbird, fly, into the light of a dark black night.
For black female country artists. I will say, you know, I personally obviously was extremely excited to see Tanner Adele on the record. This is someone who I think is really promising and does a lot of the work that I think if you had said to me 6 months ago, like, Beyonce's going to make, like, a mainstream country record, that's sort of what I think it would sound like,
sure.
Right? These singers, to me, feel underutilized on this. And also, why on this song? And why not more space?
And that's why we get back into, like, the footnoting. It's like, if you've seen Paul McCartney in the last 2 decades, he gives...
Paul McCartney, come on, Podcast Deluxe.
He gives the same canned speech every night before he sings Blackbird about how it's about the civil rights movement. And, you know, it was, like, subtle, and he had to be subtle about it. And, you know, it's this is this is known, you know, again, I'm sure it's on the Wikipedia page. Mm-hmm. And that gesture is meaningful. And it's especially meaningful coming from Beyonce. Again, a lot of people probably learned that from a TikTok over mm-hmm. the weekend. Mm-hmm. Even if you haven't had the pleasure or of going to Old Cella, whatever it was. And like, that's fine.
Which you did.
Which I did.
Yes.
But do I want to hear
a history lesson
or just like a cover of Blackbird? Like, it's straight up, especially on the, as like right after Beyonce is exploding this idea of genre. Mm-hmm. It's just, it can feel a bit didactic, and it can feel like, especially without the songs to back it up. Like, I'm not saying those songs aren't on here, but like I said this in the Drake episode, and maybe it's a craven way to think about it. But at this point in the career of a pop artist with such a body of work, I'm thinking like, what of these songs are going to make it in this live set list 5 years from now?
Right.
What are these songs? And how are you going to feel when they push out an old favorite? And what's going to be on the two disc greatest hits? And maybe that's
an old idea.
It's an old idea, but it is. But it's
in
like
the era's era. It's an old idea.
Sure. But maybe the assumption or the presumption of importance is somehow outweighing, like, on the song level. Like,
I agree.
I don't, like, Daddy Lessons to me is much more successful.
I agree.
Than Daddy the Lessons vast majority much of stuff and doing the same thing.
I totally agree. It does. It felt, I mean, organic is like a overly wasted word, but Daddy Lessons felt like an organic meeting of the minds, especially in the live performance where you have the former Dixie Chicks, now Chicks. It speaks a real comfort. It's a comfortable song.
Yeah. Feels natural.
A lot of songs on this record, there are both, to me, songs that feel frisky and also comfortable, but then there are songs that feel, I mean, you use the word didactic. To me, I would say they feel very written.
Mm-hmm.
I feel the writing in the songs. And one of the things about Beyonce as a singer is I think she's like an excellent singer, yeah, especially when she allows herself the freedom to really run. And when I said in the beginning that there's something kind of like 70s singer-songwriter and a tiny bit small to me, especially in the middle portion of this record, I kept being like, what? Where's the sing? Like the singing? Like I would like something bigger. And I do wonder, you know, I don't want to spend too much time thinking about like authorial intent. Like, it's like, that's not, I have a whole riff that I'd prepped about originalism and the Supreme Court, and like the intention of the author and the intention of the text. I had like a whole thing. But on a basic level, if you're going to at least give 5% of your brain over to like, why did Beyonce make this set of songs?
When she wants you to be thinking like that.
I mean, it's clear.
She's being forceful with
that. Yes, but if you're gonna be spending some energy thinking about the whys of it, it doesn't feel like it's about singing. It feels like it's about making a point to, I hate to say it, but to people who have historically marginalized and undersold these kinds of qualities that have always been in her music.
Right.
It's not as if these kinds of qualities weren't there 5, 10, or this even 15.
This is what I meant by the Scorsese
point. Yeah, 5, 10, or even 15 or 20 years ago. It's the literal, and I think you're right about the press release and the explaining, but what do you lose when you have to explain it? Like, who's the explaining for? Is it for young people who maybe didn't grow up with a bunch of these records to understand the broad concepts?
Valid.
Yeah. Is it for 60-year-old white Grammy voters to be like, okay, I can find my way into this record?
Valid.
Right. But again,
yeah,
that's a homework. Whether that functions as music or functions as an album is a different kind of thing. And you know, there are songs on this album that I genuinely really think are great.
Yeah, let's talk. We should talk about that.
I like Daughter a lot.
Yeah, interesting.
Can we listen to Daughter?
They keep saying that ain't nothing like my father, but I'm the furthest thing from quiet boys and altars. If you cross me, I'm just like my father. I am colder than Titanic water. Help me, Lord, from these fantasies in my head. Ain't never been safe ones. I don't fellowship with these fake ones. So let's travel to Whitechapel and sing.
I couldn't quite get my arms around this one.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't follow the storytelling, to be honest. And I wish there was a little bit more. Like, for me, hearing the singles on the album, they're really strong. I think they're
so
really
much
strong.
Especially 16 Carriages.
16 Carriages.
So much stronger on the album.
That is, to me, that's the perfect version of what, that is the next step from Daddy Lessons, is a song like 16 Carriages. It's like,
I mean, it's not Levi jeans.
I mean, we're going to talk about Levi jeans.
Girl, I want to take it home.
Like, oh wow, like this works. It's playing with the genre, but it's telling your story. And Daughter, I feel like I found it a little bit more slippery, but it's very interesting sonically, which, like, again, like, this is Beyonce. Like, are we gonna deny her like the prodigiousness of like the making of these songs? Like, mm-hmm. Of course, the level is like really is like, mm-hmm. Like she's only competing with herself. Like,
yes,
nobody else is making albums like this in the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And that's the only reason we can even talk about it at this level. So I'm not slighting that, but I'm saying like some things are more successful than others. But talk about Daughter.
Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying about the lyrics, but I do think one thing I like about it, I don't necessarily need it to be a fully coherent story. What I do think, my most favorite version of casual Beyonce is like the kind of like tossed off tisk tisk Beyonce. I think there's like a lot of that in this, in the lyrics of this song. Like I hear an embedded attitude, yeah, that to me, that's the sort of like glue that holds it together more than like a narrative through line. Anytime I'm looking for like narrative through lines on most of these songs, there are some that are like very like in almost like on Monday, this happened on Tuesday. Like there's a little bit of that, but to me, that's not the sales pitch, at least for the songs that hold up the most for me.
Tisk tisk on Jolene.
Oh, geez.
Jolene working for you?
Let's listen to Jolene first.
Jolene, 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 Jolene. I'm warning you, woman, find you your own man. Jolene, I know I'm a queen. Jolene, I'm still a Creole Benji bitch from the Louisiana.
So as has been made clear on the internet multiple times in the last week or two, Dolly Parton herself has said in the past that she wished that Beyonce would cover Jolene. Of all the covers, she wished Beyonce would cover Jolene, probably because the publishing checks would be amazing.
She's got the I Will Always Love You check.
That's true. We see you, Dolly. Also, Dolly, come on Podcast Deluxe. We sent the email. This is not a cover of Jolene.
Well,
it's not. It's a rewording and also re-attituding,
yeah,
of Jolene. The original Jolene is sung from the perspective of someone whose partner is being moved in on. Someone is sliding in the DMs. Whatever you did in the 60s or 70s to slide in the DMs, the DMs are being slid in. And you, as the person who's that person's partner, is feeling anxious and unsettled and
insecure
and worried that this incredibly alluring alternate option. Right.
There's a lot of love also. There's like hate and love in equal measure in the original, yeah, Jolene.
And this anxiety that this other tantalizing but attractive unknown quantity can disrupt the sense of calm and peace that you have. That is not what this version of Jolene is. This version is the
I'm a queen.
Getting the hammer out.
Yeah.
This is, can we say that?
Yeah. Yeah. She says it.
This version is about I will do you violence.
Yeah.
This is not I am uncertain of where I stand. This is not I am on unsteady territory. This is not I think I might lose my man. This is actually like, it's not me. Jolene is like the singer versus the interloper. This is about the power couple versus the interloper, which is something that Beyonce has touched on previously.
Right. It
and
is,
Dolly alludes to.
It's both a retread of Lemonade,
yes,
basically.
Of course.
You mm-hmm. know, it's a story we know mm-hmm. from this artist. But it's like it's it's a pretty audacious swing to flip Jolene in that way.
Tim, okay, I think I like it a little more than you, but I don't want to pretend calling it a cover of Jolene is wrong. I wonder, in this particular musical, cultural, and historical moment, how a Beyoncé cover of Jolene would hit. I don't know that people would connect with it. I think because that energy of vulnerability,
you wouldn't buy it.
It doesn't feel true to the overall Beyoncé project. This is a Beyoncé filtered version of that kind of interaction. I mostly like it. I think it's good, but I don't mistake it for an emotional or literal cover of the original.
Sure. It's interesting because there are a lot of, you know, Jolene sort of spins throughout history, and like Cam, country singer, who's on this album, has one. It doesn't super work for me sonically. Like, I don't love the phrasing or the production of the Jolene flip. But it just really takes me, like, the robbing of the plaintiveness of the original just takes me out of it. And, like, just plainly, like, it's too obvious. Like,
there's a lot of obvious things, like, on this record.
It's just, nobody needs to cover Jolene on an album that is or isn't about country music.
Okay, but to pick up on what I was saying before, like, and just briefly sidebar, is this Beyoncé saying to the Grammys,
I dare you?
Yeah, like, literally, you won't give it to me for Lemonade. You won't give it to me for Renaissance. All great records.
Self-titled.
Like,
B-Day. Whatever.
But if I make a record referencing like 5 to 10 of the most important, like, quote unquote, with real instruments, white songs of all time in genres that you Grammy voters really dig.
I dare you.
Is that what this is? And if the answer is yes, why do that? Who's that for?
For, like, the mantle, you know? It's like the LeBron Jamesification, the, like, creating your legacy in real time. Like, and that's fine. Like, you know, she showed up when she became the winningest Grammy person.
She did.
Both times.
Yes.
When she tied, when she won. You know, Jay gave that speech this year. Was that the beginning of this campaign? Like, these people are, you know, they are very methodical. Like,
yes.
We know how this works. It's interesting that we now have confirmation that this album has been in the works not only since the pandemic, but 5 years predating the pandemic. Seems like it was going to be before Renaissance. She said she had to put out the dance one to sort of rouse after COVID. But this is, and she said, you know, I recorded 100 songs for this. Like, this is a project that she has worked over many times. And I do think it's okay to have an end goal in mind when you're this far into your career. But again, just as a pure listening experience, you know, you get to something like Jolene. And I felt the same way, honestly, about using I Feel Love on Renaissance and the outro of Renaissance. Like, okay, we get it. It's a dance album. Like, there's a million Donna Summer references that we've heard fewer times.
Yeah, it's sort
and
of...
I don't know if your spin is enough to make it worth
and also
this card.
To get back to the kind of sampling conversation, which is, if you think about the 80s into the 90s, there was a moment, and it's not a clean break from one phase to the next, but there's like the obscure sample moment. There's the crate digging moment of like, not only can I take a fragment of a pre-existing thing and build an entirely new thing atop it. It's also, I did it off a thing you've never heard of. And that is the musicality. That's what's inherently musical about what I did is I found this thing, I remade it, I built it from scratch. And 40 years from now, DJ Jazzy Jeff is going to play it live, like figure out the sample live and like blow people's minds because they haven't figured it out, right? So there's that. And then there's the Puffy era and the Dr. Dre era and of like incredibly big, obvious samples, which turned hip hop into global pop. I'm not saying one of those is right and one of those is wrong, but they do feel like two different approaches to musicality. And so it's strange to me because I fundamentally believe Beyoncé probably has listened to all the stuff and has done all the homework,
she knows
and all the researching. She gets it. I believe that. given that, these are strange choices to me. And they do feel like a tiny bit of a taunt.
Good Vibrations is another one.
Yeah, Good Vibrations. It does feel like a tiny bit of a taunt to a hypothetical Grammy voter.
She's picking up Good Vibrations. He's looking for sweet sensations. Ladies.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I literally covered the Beatles. The Beach Boys are on this record.
I don't want to go too far and say that there are not subtle allusions here. You know, like a song that really works for me on this album is Bodyguard, which has like a lot of live bass and it's Raphael Sadiq.
Yeah.
And there's like Motown references there. I think there's like even like a Neil Young song that they're sort of nodding to. I saw mentioned in a review, I think that was Carl Wilson on Slate who called that one out. Like there is stuff, there is deeper stuff to pull here. You know, there's an Underworld sample. Like that's like... Only Beyonce is going to sing Good Vibrations and sample Underworld in at this level. But there's a lot of stuff in there's a lot of in your face stuff.
What else works for you besides Bodyguard? Because Bodyguard to me is could have appeared on almost like five other prior Beyonce
which
albums.
Is one of the reasons that I like it. I think it's like feels like a hit.
It's a classic
Beyonce. Yeah. I think the back half of this album is stronger than the front half.
Definitely.
Yeah. I think Two Hands to Heaven to me. This is a time where the double eyes mean two instead of just I.
Yeah.
Just the inconsistency of the style guide bothers me. But
we're sending it to standards.
This song has a lot of different pieces. It feels virtuosic.
Yeah.
In a way that only Beyonce can pull off.
It feels like it plays with tempo, it plays with texture, it plays with singing versus rapping, it plays with different kinds of singing versus other different kinds of singing, all within like, you know, 45 second span. That's a song to me that also frankly could have been on prior Beyonce projects to my ear.
Would have been a standout on any Beyonce project.
It's
vocally it's like, strong.
It's like if you have come this far in the episode and you're a person who's still like, I don't understand what Beyonce does well, listen to this. Like, let's play a little bit of it because this is what Beyonce does well.
16 switches, candy, apple, green, candy, paint, swirling 24 inch spinners. Swirl. Don't judge me, baby. You would never judge me, baby. Bottle in my hand, my whiskey up high. Two hands to heaven, coyotes run wild. Oh, God only knows why.
That whole stretch, I think, Riverdance, you know, that's like a more interesting Dolly reference to me than just doing Jolene.
You like Yaya?
Yeah, I'm like, is that going to be the standout track of this?
It's a good Tina Turner song, right?
Yeah, right. Like, and which is a good Tina Turner, you know, that's Beyonce's queen as it should be. It was interesting to see. Seems like some of this stuff got added after. I think Yaya's not on the vinyl, which the fans
the pre-order CD. Yeah. We got a couple emails about that, and then I was looking online. It seems that a lot of people. So basically, I think if you pre-ordered the vinyl or the CD, you do not have the final version of the album. You have like a earlier pre-clearance version
of the
album.
Which, like, welcome to the streaming. It's Beyonce. Like, she's not going to stop futzing. So I think there's a lot of good stuff on here. Okay, the two duets. Is it 4D chess for Beyonce to feature two artists, Miley Cyrus and Post Malone, who have tried on genre like a costume, specifically black genres, and now are moving into their very white phases? Is that, or are they just popular artists who appear on this album?
I felt more that way with the Post Malone song than with the Miley song.
Although I think Miley's pivot is even more known and dramatic.
I agree, but I guess to me, hearing Beyonce and Miley sing together felt more natural to me. Like, I felt like it was a better musical choice. Whereas hearing Post Malone, who, like, part of the reason that Post Malone can be effective in all these spaces is there's something fundamentally neutral about Post Malone.
I think
he has soft edges. He has there's fuzz, and I mean this vocally.
Yeah.
I was watching someone on Twitter or TikTok was just talking about like what an incredible singer Post Malone is, and I was like, it's interesting because like that's both true and not true. He's like incredibly, there's a lot of technical gift, but he forever sounds like he's singing behind a wall. Like there's always something between your ear and his vocal. And so having him on the same song as Beyonce, one of the most present singers of the last 20 years, that doesn't quite hit the same. Whereas Miley, you can argue, is like sometimes too far in front of the, like too far out in front.
Right. So she doesn't need the microphone.
Yeah. Like, so, but hearing the two of them play against each other is actually to me much better. So I like what you're saying. I'm even thinking it might be true.
I think it's true. I've been thinking about it a lot, and I was like, oh, like it's a funny coincidence, or like, you know, these two, they get away with murder. And now I'm like, nah, like Beyonce doesn't.
So how come Kid Rock is not on this album? And how come Kid Rock's not on this album?
He missed the studio
session. He definitely missed the studio session.
He and the Dream did not get along.
Who else would be in that category?
Of someone who could be on this. Oh, well, MGK. That's what MGK. I was talking about at the beginning. You know, it's like you want to be black or you want to be white in terms of genre right now.
Is there someone else? I'm trying to think. Jelly Roll.
Yeah.
Why isn't Jelly Roll on this record?
That would be a good duet partner.
That
would
genuine, like an actually good duet.
Yeah. And then there are the upcoming black artist features, mostly
who are not
country genre.
Yes. Who are not on Blackbird.
Right. You got Shaboozey.
Yeehaw Future.
Has what, two features on this album?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the duet with Willie Jones.
Less successful.
Yeah, right? This is the thing. I'm like, as a gesture, I get it, and it's huge. And like, especially because going back, like Beyonce has gotten flack. One of the few things she's gotten flack for is like borrowing liberally from smaller artists and not putting them on. You know, it makes me think of like conversations around Rosalia, like professional cultural appropriators,
yes.
Collage artists.
Yes.
Some of the best artists of our time are accused of that wildly.
The auteurs
Drake,
of that.
Of course.
Yeah.
So for her to take these guys and give them shine, like that's very meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like, Shaboozey's not good enough to be on a Beyonce album.
Yeah.
To me. I don't need to hear.
Is it good enough to be on a future record?
I don't need to, like, I don't know if you disagree, but I'm just like, I don't come to this level of project to hear this guy. It's like,
I felt the same sort of about Willie Jones, who I think has had some success, but I think from a vocal power perspective, again,
it's not a fair fight.
Yeah, no, it's not a fair. I think it's exactly right. Yeah.
But then there's, you know, we can go out with another one of my favorites, unless you want to throw
go
one
for
in.
It.
I think Alligator Tears, that's a song with a dream. That's
that's interesting.
More in the to me, I prefer it to, you shouted out Daughter, and I'm like, I think that they're sort of playing in the same.
Interesting. This is one of my least favorite.
All right.
Yeah, but go for it. Yeah.
So what do you dislike about it?
There's that run of songs, right before and after Alligator Tears.
I mean,
Tears.
Spaghetti, we shouldn't talk about the Thanos line.
It's
that's some of her
the which line?
The Thanos line. Some of her worst rapping.
Yeah. To me, when I'm talking about like the singer-songwriter stuff, I think the sort of parallel thing or the kind of accompanying thing I'm saying is there's a dourness.
Mm.
And I think, you know, Beyonce is so fundamentally alive that anytime I hear something that feels a little dour, I'm just like, this is an odd choice. Even if it's a proactive choice, it still doesn't feel totally in line with the gifts. And this was like kind of in the middle of a run that I felt like took the energy down. Didn't feel as sophisticated as some of the other songs we talked about in terms of complexity. I don't know, but tell me what you like about it.
I think it's an original sound. I think it's like a new twist. Like it's the kind of song that makes me stop and think like, what is she doing here in a big musical buffet, you know? And like, I would have in a more concentrated version of this album, like I would have liked to hear her with like a lot of acoustic, like just doing acoustic guitar singer songwriter stuff, but with a Beyonce twist.
Right.
And I think this goes
to fully lean into that.
Yes. And I think this goes down that direction.
You and your alligator tears wakes me over. You say move a mountain and I'll throw on my boots. You say stop the river from running, I'll build a dam or two.
Speaking of Yeehaw Future, is actual Future Yeehaw Future?
Not yet, but he'll do it at some point.
Future Miley Beyonce on a fake Lil Nas X song.
Future and Miley have a song together, right?
Yes, no, that's what I'm saying. No, I'm saying what I'd like is, like, you know, we're not that far off.
Future might be the only artist to collaborate with Beyonce, Taylor Swift, and Miley Cyrus.
And Kendrick Lamar.
Which, let's just go in. If you would have asked me 2 weeks ago the thing I want least on a Future album, I might say a Kendrick Lamar verse. And yet, he shows up and he fits in.
Yeah.
On this song. We're talking about Like That.
Yeah.
By Future and Metro Boomin, featuring Kendrick Lamar.
Yes. Talking out of their neck, don't put no coughing out of your mouth. I'm way too paranoid for a threat. Hey, let's get it, bro. DOT, the money, power, respect.
The last one is better.
Say yes, a lot of goofies with a check. I mean, I'll hold them sentiments symbolic. My temperament bipolar, I choose violence. Okay, let's get it up. It's time for him to prove that he's a pro.
With the everlasting bass sample.
Yes. With Ronnie O and Joe Cooley.
Yep. You may know from Wayne using it. You may know from E40 using it. I like this song. I think it's pretty good.
Yeah.
I didn't think I did. I didn't think, like I said, Kendrick could fit here. There's a lot of things, like Beyonce, this album is created with a lot of moments that are meant to be screenshotted and discursive. There's the Prodigy samples throughout of him talking trash, which the greatest of all time, maybe, at doing that.
Stop questioning my taste making.
Yeah. I mean, yes, we could
go all day.
Rest in peace. But all the obvious samples that seem aimed at a particular Canadian former collaborator, and like the stunt of getting Kendrick on this, like, at first I thought the song was a stunt, and now a week or so later, I'm like, oh, it works.
It works on the album.
And you see it, like, this song is popular. The song is legitimately popular.
Yes.
Number one, it's going to be the number one song in America this week. It's probably going to be the number one song in America next week, even though the Beyonce album came out. Mm-hmm. Like, the song, it's I think it's working. Yeah, exactly. What about you?
Okay, but this album, look, separate from this song, this is an incredibly good album.
It's the first Future album you've loved in a long time.
It really is. Like,
me too. Like Hendrix, maybe?
Yeah, I feel like was it last year that they did the vinyl box set of all the mixtapes?
Yeah, end of last year.
Yeah. So, like, I hadn't listened to the mixtapes in a while. So I went back to listen to the mixtapes. For the record, if you buy the vinyl, some songs are missing because I guess they weren't clear. Sure. But whatever. I went back to listen to the tapes. It's just like, damn.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
Monster,
unbelievable.
Mode, 56 just Nights.
Unbelievable run, right? That the future of like 2018 onwards or 17 onwards is maybe not that future.
Yeah,
but this is maybe as close. Maybe he had to like step away for a while.
He did. He took a little bit of a break.
Yeah, to get back in that bag a tiny bit. But like this future, chef's kiss. Really no notes. I don't know if that's Metro giving him the right beats. I don't know if it's a psychological like
warfare with a former collaborator.
Well, yes, of course. But like, is it a headspace thing? Is it a beat thing? I'm not entirely sure. I do think these are some of Metro's best beats
in a while.
Yeah. So, but I think it's some of Future's best rapping in a while. I think this is an incredibly successful album. And yet, why is all that anyone is talking about the Kendrick thing? It's not that I don't understand, but this is when we're talking about meta narratives and we're talking about discourse. Like, obviously I'm happy that people are talking about this album, but they're not really talking about this album.
Right.
This album is a successful album top to bottom.
Yep.
People aren't talking about that. They're just talking about this one moment or two or three moments.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just how music marketing functions now. And even as a great auteur artist, you have to think of 2, 3, 50, 75, 500 touch points for people to talk about. Maybe that's how it works. But it's frustrating to me because I think when people look back on this album, they're going to think Kendrick. And I wish that when people look back on this album, they'll be like, damn, Future was really back on his back.
Here's what I'm going to say. future albums that are good have legs. And I do think
that they're like Sub Rosa legs.
But they're like outside legs. You know what I mean? They're like car test legs. They're like club legs. They're like down south radio legs. You're going to hear these songs all summer, I think. We'll see what happens with the next album they're putting out like in 2 weeks or whatever.
That's confirmed.
Yeah, April 12th, I think. They must have another thing planned. But I do think it took that little Easter egg, to go back to the earlier conversation, it took that shift in the meta narrative to get people back to being excited about a future album. Like, he puts out so much music, you know, unlike Beyonce, but similarly to Drake, he's not really changing his subject matter. He's not really changing his sound over the years.
Yeah.
But he's not really criticized for it because you know what you're getting when you come to Future. But you do need that one little extra thing to be like, and in the mixtape run, that extra thing was the dissolution of his relationship with Sierra.
Yeah.
And his return to villain status.
Yes.
And even if it's subtle, and you can sort of project it onto everything. Like, once you realize that he might be on bad terms with Drake, and certainly Metro Boomin is, You can try to project that.
You're number one fan, dog.
He calls Drake his number one fan on the first song on the
album. Also, should we put the article that I did after the follow show, or is Drake his rap's biggest fan?
I mean,
should we just Future? Do you think Future has a subscription? Do you have a login?
The reason
why Wordle?
The diss is good, that diss specifically, is because it's correct.
Yes.
Like, Drake, like, when you say something true about someone, that's when it really works. So to me, honestly, the Future shot at Drake, if that's in fact what it is at the beginning of that album, is more potent than anything Kendrick says.
Yeah, I will say this.
I want to unpack the Kendrick verse a little bit.
Okay.
And then we'll talk about how people are unpacking the Kendrick verse.
Okay. I don't know the meme. Is it the Arnold meme with the fist?
That's Arthur. Sorry. You're not a millennial. Arnold? Do you know the difference between Arnold and Arthur?
No. Whatever, the fist meme, that's the Kendrick verse. It's so like I know, but like, come on, man, just make another classic record. Like what are we doing here? Like, it's
you don't like him in that mode?
I know I do, but I'm just like, dudes are lapping you. Like, they're making outstanding records, or they're making huge hits. I understand that the fundamental premise of Kendrick is, I don't play that game.
Yeah.
I don't do that.
Yeah.
I absolutely understand that. But it's like, when you're like, there's no big three, it's just big me. It's just like a little like I just, there's something about it that feels inappropriately testy. It's just like, it's kind of like,
well, he did that with Control, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, obviously it's a thing. Yeah. And I understand, like, Kendrick is invested in that conversation in a way that, frankly, a lot of guys of my generation are invested in that conversation.
Like, how dare you mention those guys alongside?
Right. And it's like, I get it. I grew up in that environment.
Hip hop is a
rappers. Yeah. Like, rappers going each other constantly. Like, I get it. And I understand that Drake is also like the master of the sneak diss. Like, he's doing it, but he's not doing it, but he's doing it. So it's not that Drake is above or beneath, or Kendrick is above or beneath. They just do it in very different ways.
Yeah.
But there is something like lightly petulant about the way Kendrick does it. And I would almost say that the way Drake, I mean, hasn't responded yet, maybe never will, but there'll be like some incredibly elegant dance of a thing in the middle of a number one hit 3 years from now. That'll be like, oh, and it's just, they're playing two different games. It's like college ball and pro ball, or like softball and baseball. They're just
like
different
Prince
games.
And Michael Jackson.
Prince.
So this, to me, that's the real line. It's like, he's getting at what you're getting at, but I want to unpack it, because he says, Kendrick says, in reference, presumably, to him and Drake, who is constantly referencing Michael Jackson.
Yes.
Prince outlived Mike Jack. Now, taken literally, they both had unfortunate
ends with substance-related deaths.
He didn't outlive him by that long. The music that he made in the time after Michael Jackson, it doesn't really hold up to scrutiny.
Oh,
but you know what he means?
I know what he means. It's interesting.
He means like, I'm an artist and you're a pop star.
Michael Jackson was an artist.
Of course. That's why I'm saying it doesn't really, it's like, it's the best line in the verse to me, but it also doesn't really hold up when you look at it close. Like, he's trying to say the thing that you're saying, which is we play different games. Like, you can have your number one hits. Mm-hmm. I'll just pop out and be a genius.
But this is what people always get wrong about Drake. And you would think Kendrick would be an astute enough listener to not get it wrong about Drake. Now, obviously, like, there's a difference between like what you know and what you put in a verse. They can be different. But it's like the thing that people fundamentally get wrong about Drake is reducing him to statistics and success.
He does that a little bit to himself.
Yeah, but it's like if I had those statistics of success, I probably would as well. Right. But a lot of times people weaponize that against his artistry. Yeah. And Drake is fundamentally... truly one of the most artistically successful huge pop stars of the 21st
century. Similar to Michael Jackson.
Yes, the 21st century. You know, what Kendrick is saying, obviously, is like, we talked about auteurs before. He's like, I'm the auteur and you're the sort of frivolous guy. It's not true.
About either of those guys or about either of these guys. Also, like, Prince was quite prolific, I will say.
Extremely. And like, frankly, late in career, to very mixed effect.
Yeah, right.
Like, there's just a lot of late Prince that's like, you know, which is not great. That said, I once watched Prince play in a room genuinely not much bigger than this room, like maybe twice the size of this room, for like 4 hours. It was unreal. Yeah. Like, it was like, it's not Beyonce at Coachella, but like, just because it couldn't possibly be, but like for a show of that size, unfathomably good.
Sure.
Astonishing.
Yeah.
So I have no knocks on Prince, and fundamentally I have no knocks on Kendrick. I just like this mode of Kendrick. It's like,
but do you think it's a warning shot though? Like, it's like,
he wants to get
Drake out to play.
It just, the thing about great beef, effective beef in hip hop or elsewhere, is the sense that the two people who are beefing are plausibly facing off in the same space. Obviously not in the same room, but in the same space. Their levels are at the same, like they're facing each other. This Kendrick verse, and frankly, Control, which like is the type of thing that people lose their minds over, but they largely are losing their minds over because nobody does it anymore. Right. So like someone does it and you're like, oh, right. But the thing about this verse,
how to rob thing.
Yes, exactly.
Saying names, yes. Basically.
The thing about this verse and also Control, but to me, this verse, because of how late in their careers it's coming, it doesn't feel like Kendrick and Drake are facing each other.
You don't think they're peers.
It's not that they're not peers. It's just that Kendrick feels like he's commenting on a thing that he is on the outside of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. Like, I'm not saying that that's not valid or an approach, but it makes it feel, to me, stakesless. Like, it's not like, you know, all the sort of follow-up posts about Drake of like a live show. It's like, Drake's not bothered. Like, Drake's this.
Yeah,
Drake's, and maybe he is, maybe he's not. I don't know. But like, if those are right, Drake's not bothered, because it's like, it's the definition of like, you're on the outside of the club and you can't get in. That's how this feels.
But
as
what
of,
the
which
Pusha
is why
T
it's
beef.
The fist.
Like, Pusha T way further from Drake than Kendrick in any sort of like,
but clearly news, but clearly is so well connected and connected to Kanye and knows certain information that was weaponized against Drake. That's a different kind of insiderness. Kendrick, obviously, much more successful than Pusha T as an artist.
Like guerrilla warfare.
It's like Kendrick is delivering essayistic commentary on the rap game in the shape of a Drake diss.
Yeah.
Pusha T is like, I'm coming for your neck. Like, I wish you gone.
Right.
And that, to me, is not exactly what's happening on this verse.
So to me, the interesting thing about this verse, even more so than the verse itself, is the conversation it's generated. This goes back to what we're talking about with Beyonce. And it also touches on a thread, I think, of pop fandom, standom even, that is especially pernicious right now, which is that everything is QAnon. Everything is like, you know, the yarn on the wall with the pictures and like, this means that, and this means that, and this is actually a reference to that. And like, people are losing their minds. Like, you saw the clip from Dissect Pod that was like, actually, here's all the layers to the Kendrick verse.
But Goofies with a Check is also a Drake diss, with Goofy being a cartoon dog, a play on For All My Dogs, and a check being the logo for Nike, who Drake collabs with. Kendrick is calling Drake Goofy, a non-threatening dog that's popular but not feared.
I mean, it's the geniusification of rap understanding. It's the dissectification of rap understanding. Yeah. It's the
so
sense.
Literal.
The what?
It's so literal.
It's so literal. And also it suggests that the full understanding of a piece of music is reduced to I get the reference, right, or I recognize the reference. And this is also what we're talking about with the Beyonce thing.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's like Beyonce's being very deliberate and being like, here are the loudest possible, I'm painting with primary colors. It's the loudest possible reference points so that everybody can be like, I see the reference points. Yeah. And again, you can do that and make great music, or you can do that and make mid music or bad music. It's not inherently connected to quality.
Sure.
But it is connected to volume of discourse
and content,
and the presumption that if you have successfully referenced A, B, C, and D, that you're doing a good thing. And this is where, I mean, I was joking before about like originalism and kind of like Supreme Court, but it's like a lot of these reads feel like originalist reads of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, the same people who are getting pumped about getting the references are probably the same kind of people who are like, I wish the Supreme Court would not deliver originalist reads on the Constitution. I'm just saying, think about it. Give it some thought. That's all I'm saying.
You had to get that.
I'm just saying, give it some thought. Yeah. I'm just saying. But to me, it makes a certain kind of listener or fan feel like they solved it.
Yeah.
And music is not to be solved.
Right.
It's not a puzzle to be solved.
My favorite.
I hate the idea that like somehow if you follow this thread to this link to that thread, that you understand everything about a piece of music.
Yeah.
That could not be farther from the truth.
Right. My favorite one of these is the track titles, like that every track title
is sort of answer.
Sort of like answer theoretically. To track title. Mm-hmm. And then you reference like, you know, Drake gives these speeches on stage every night on tour and people are like, oh, he's responding to Kendrick. And then other people are like, no, Drake does this every night.
Yes.
You know, like there's a lot of content, but also it works. Like it really works. And they both play into it. You know, the IG captions is another one. Drake does dumb little rhymey IG captions all the time. He's not doing them now instead of making an answer
diss
track. But then, like, they play into it. Because, like, I don't know if you saw last night, LeBron rapped along to the Kendrick verse during pregame warm-ups. All the blogs posted. That's one cycle of content. Then Drake, shout out to Elliot Wilson, taps the like button on the post of the clip of LeBron, his best pal, his, you know, his I'm LeBron. He's, you know, like, so they play into it and it really works. Like this Future album is extremely successful. The highest selling Future album.
But if this song was not
A Lot of Time to Be Alive.
But if this song was not on the Future album, it would still be incredibly successful. And
I don't know about that.
It
would be good, but I don't know that it would be as successful.
Like, you mean commercially?
Yes.
And it's still a great album. So it's still a great album.
Let's go out. We'll just do what on this album is working for you. No, I mean,
we barely talked about the Mobb Deep stuff.
Yep.
Like, Seen It All. Like, obviously, it's a great record.
Me and my brothers, we've been freaks in rotation. Sometimes they move on, they still can't replace. I lose a star and get replaced the same day. From trapping out my granny house to rapping on the stage. I want it all. I know these streets gonna have to feed me.
It's nice to hear Future rapping on a beat like that. That's so like out of his typical comfort zone. Like you don't think of Future, like a lot of, you know, you think of like the radio freestyle of just like rappers going to the LA Leakers or whatever and being like, I can rap on anything. I can rap on a Nas beat. I can rap on a Dub C and the Mad Circle beat, whatever. Future's never been a guy that's like going to go up to the radio station and rap on a random New York beat.
Sure.
So it's nice to hear.
Yeah.
Like I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah.
Ice Attack.
Yeah. I mean, the
Cinderella,
incredible.
Fried.
The back half of this album.
So good.
Where My Twin At? Incredible. To me,
that's one of my least favorites.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of my least favorites.
There is some beat variation, like you're saying, hearing Future on like a New York style beat, but also Everyday Hustle with him doing like a ornate Rick Ross style beat with Ross, another person who Drake has been, you know, maybe sparring with low key for
a while. Did Ross actually unfollow Drake, or was that just like some...
I don't know. Did Drake actually invite Rick Ross's ex to his concert the following night? Like, seems like he did. I don't know. Like, but this is the stuff. And then you get the people looking back at old Drake songs and Drake verses in a new light, sort of being like, oh, he saw this coming.
No, but like, even just seeing how excited you are right now.
I love it.
But it's stressing me out.
But I love it because it adds a little bit of stakes and fun for Drake and Future, two of my favorite artists who might be like plateauing, you know, who are just like, well, what am I, like, Drake's still going to be rapping about Kanye? No, he has new fire. He has new, and Future has new, like, it's just that little twist of motivation.
So you're saying it's indivisible, that Future needs the meta antagonism in order to deliver an album of this level of this level of quality.
And it's, yeah, it's like, again, to keep with the sports parallels, it's like the in-season tournament. It's like they just added one more little layer of competition to allow people who are great but so successful that they don't have that much to go on.
I guess what I would say is I am completely confident that both Future and Drake and Kendrick and whatever have made music premised upon actual tensions and fraughtness in their personal and professional lives that's been mid.
Fine, but also you're saying this is the best Future album in a while, so it could be a coincidence, could not. And the last thing I'll say about why it like gets me going that these two are going at each other is like your point about Kendrick Lamar, where he's like not actually in the same space as Drake. Like, Future is a good foil for him.
That I totally agree with. And like, if should it come to actual all out like song warfare, I would much rather hear all-out song warfare between Drake and Future than between Drake and Kendrick.
Or even just 5 years of subs. It's fine.
It's fine, too.
Should we go out with a Future song from this segment?
Better than a tweet about a Future song. Yeah.
Why are you upset? It's fun.
It's fine. Just play the song.
What do you want to hear? All right, we're going to play Everyday Hustle.
Meet me at the nearest coast stop. Middle of the slum, standing at the boat dock. Loading up cash, moving in the U-Haul. Went inside my bag when I took a roof off.
Let's talk about songs.
I'm too worked up already.
Are you sure? But I think actually your song is actually like, this is the energy level for your song.
Let's just do it.
Go in.
We should have done the whole episode on this.
We could have done a 5-part series on this.
I love it. Camila Cabello featuring Playboi Carti and Gucci Mane finally came out after what's felt like months of teasing. Totally confused. What is this rebrand? Why is she doing this?
What
time signature is this song in?
Can I briefly acknowledge our friends at Nymphet alumni who posted a hilarious meme about the consensual hyperpop rebrand, which we'll show here. Shout out to y'all. I don't know if they made the meme or just found the meme, but anyway, also shout out to our friend Addison Ray.
This song and video dropped. This is what I want out of popular music.
Yeah.
It's all ideas from the underground.
Yeah.
Boiled up.
Or not really.
Taken by El Guincho. Collaborator of Rosalia, who like invented more of this stuff than whoever else you think Camila Cabello is ripping off.
Yes.
It totally insane song. Keeps me on my toes the whole time. When the final little twist happens and you get Playboi Carti rapping over like an extra layer of synth and 808, like his deep voice flow. It's just the video, just a total pastiche of all my favorite things. Playboi Carti's still at the gas station.
Yeah.
He's been living at the gas station.
Seriously. Do you think it's the same gas station or are you think he's just traveling?
The history of Camila Cabello and the team that made this video waiting for Playboi Carti to come out of the freezer at the gas station. Like, how long did they have to post up and wait for him to show up to actually shoot this video?
Okay. So the key credits, and I had to pull it up.
Yeah.
Like, I also like this song. I don't know if I love it, but I like it a lot.
I love it.
I do like it a lot. The real stars here, directed by Nicolas Mendez, produced by Canada.
Yep.
Don't know who those people are.
Shout out to Canada.
You
did it.
they did it. And obviously the recurring punchline about Camila Cabello is she lacks a foundational style. She's forever.
You can say that again.
Yes. She is forever reinventing. You know, even our good friend Bebe Rexha and Rita Ora have more formed styles right, than Camila Cabello.
Yes, they found the home.
Yes, than Camila Cabello. I would say 99 times out of 100, you would hear a quote-unquote pop star. To me, debatable whether Camila Cabello is like a genuine A-list pop star. But you hear a pop star trying something on like this on as a style, and 99 times out of 100, you'd be like, damn, that feels wrong. Why does it feel so right on this record? The reason it feels so right is that there is no actual raw material to play with.
Yeah.
It's all outer shell. It's all costume. It's all performance. Why is there a random Gucci Mane interpolation in the middle of the song? I have no idea.
It doesn't fit. It
doesn't fit at all. But like, okay, so the director, A plus. The video producer, A plus. The song producer, A plus. The songwriter, A plus. The A&R executive, A plus plus plus. Everyone involved in this song, A plus. Camila Cabello, B.
Doesn't
B
matter.
Minus. Doesn't matter. Genuinely doesn't matter. This is a bizarre artifact.
It's really strange.
Performed mess that results in actual mess, which to me is like what pop music should be.
Can I just, okay, I'm going to do part of the video.
When
can you
shoots,
do the response?
Yeah, she shoots up the bed.
Yeah. like what in tarnation is going on here?
It's trying so hard that it's actually avant-garde.
I actually agree with that. Including Playboi Carti, you saw her talking about how like she just like DM'd him and then he wrote back CC.
Yep.
Do you think they still talk?
I hope so.
Getting Playboi Carti to show up anywhere, that's the Herculean task of anybody, you know, ask Aiden Ross. getting Playboi Carti to show up for anything or anywhere is a real challenge. The fact that this song exists,
the video exists,
everybody did an amazing job here. I do not know if Camila Cabello can do this 5 times
No.
But this particular thing, it's so weird. It reminds me a little bit of the 645 AR FKA Twigs song.
Totally.
Yeah. It's so strange. And it's such an unlikely intersection. Although I feel like in that song, those are two artists completely aware of how weird the thing that they're doing is and leaning the F in.
Sure.
And really finding that common thread in a musical sense. I'm genuinely not sure either of these people knew what this thing was going to turn out to be when they sat down or stood up to do it.
The last thing I will say,
sorry, I have so many thoughts
on
this.
We genuinely could
have done the whole episode on this.
The last thing I'll say, last time Camila Cabello had a big single, when she did Havana with Young Thug.
With Thug, yeah.
That was like the rebirth of Young Thug. That made him a whole new mainstream figure.
A plausible pop rap collaborator.
We've been talking about the breadcrumbs of Playboi Carti sort of coming for the mainstream. This is like in addition to the Travis Scott feature, this is the song he has on streaming services, even though he's been putting out a lot of music.
Yeah,
like this is a big look. Let's just play it. You want to take us down a notch? I'm too worked up.
Yeah. My song is very different. but from another viral star.
Right.
Another viral star.
Good transition.
Yeah, right? Yeah. First of all, my question at the end of this long episode, why is my guy Oliver Anthony Music, why was he not on Cowboy Carter? I'm just saying. Like this... Talk about a way to really like plant a flag, tell an interesting story,
Outsider, insider.
Bridge divides in America, which both Beyonce and Oliver Anthony in their own ways are curious about doing, and the redemptive power of music to do that. I'm just saying, someone, why do we have to think of all the good ideas is really what I'm saying. Over the weekend on Easter, Oliver Anthony / Oliver Anthony Music put out Hymnal of a Troubled Man's Mind. This is a album produced also with old instruments. I mean, come on. Anyway,
it's going to be on the deluxe.
Deluxe of Hymnal or deluxe of Cowboy Carter?
He's going to be on the Cowboy Carter deluxe.
So most of these songs, so this is his debut album. Most of these songs are re-recorded / quasi-polished versions of the songs that he's been putting out on YouTube and other streaming services. Dave Cobb produced this album, but I guess to Dave Cobb's credit, a lot of these Cobb productions in the last few years have felt kind of like studiously homogenized, like kind of like pumped up roots music. This doesn't feel like that. This
he let
really
Oliver Anthony Cook.
Yeah, it just has a lot of space. You know, they recorded it in like an old church or whatever with like good acoustics. I mostly prefer the original versions because the original versions of these songs are literally just Oliver Anthony and a guitar sitting in a field somewhere, screaming his head off into a microphone. Very affecting. So I kind of, most of this album, as much as I like these songs, I don't need these versions. Like I have the versions that predate them. Those to me remain the canonical versions. There's one new song at the end of this album. It's called Mama's Been Hurtin'. It does the thing that a lot of the great Oliver Anthony songs do, which is express skepticism about the American experiment, although maybe not the type of skepticism about the American experiment that most of the music that we like and most of the musicians that we like tend to express, but a sort of parallel skepticism. The way that he sings it, it's probably among the most unhinged singing on the record. And I think for him and his voice, that's the best version of Oliver Anthony singing. It's good storytelling. It's measured in terms of pacing, but in terms of emotion, it's really like, it's off the charts. I don't really know what's going to happen for Oliver Anthony. I don't know if he's going to make a much more quote unquote polished record. I have no idea if he's going to be more of a voice of the people person who just does big tours. He's in the middle of a big tour right now, playing for thousands of people in a bunch of likely and also unlikely places. So there's still some motion there. I don't know what that's going to look like 6 months or 12 months from now. To me, this entire album feels like potentially the capstone on the original version of what he brought. And then maybe the next phase, he'll have an era. Maybe he'll have an era. But
Mario's coming.
Mama's Been Hurtin' is maybe the capstone on this 1.0 version of Oliver Anthony Music. Beyonce, take a listen, I guess.
Never there's been hard times. It's always made hard folks. Who could get her to the other side and not let it be all she wrote? I'd love to live to be an old man, but God, you can take me a young one.
Mama's Been Hurting, Daddy Lessons. Like, someone mashed those up for us.
Or not. So much like the Oliver Anthony album, Jesus Was Risen on Sunday.
Okay.
But it
strong,
took us,
strong pivot.
But it took us a minute.
wild pivot. Wild
took
pivot.
Us a minute to get to our Easter candy of choice.
Yeah.
The snack of the week this week, not bought on
has
discount.
Has it passed its expiration date?
You think it expired right
on Easter? Yeah, I don't know.
These are the Dr. Pepper flavored peeps.
Okay, can I be really candid? Because this has come up for me in some conversations that I've had over the years.
These peeps?
Peeps, just peeps in general.
Oh yeah, you a peeps guy?
No.
Right.
Almost, I don't think
it's not a good snack.
I don't think I ever even tried peeps until 5 to 10 years ago. I was unaware of their existence.
Your first peep was 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think so. I don't get it.
I don't get it either, but you love Dr. Pepper.
Love Dr. Pepper.
All right, so you're going to tell us if this
also,
is true.
Also, You like cherry Dr. Pepper?
I don't really drink soda.
But like you've tried, you never tried it?
I don't think I've ever had cherry Dr. Pepper.
Cherry Dr. Pepper, like it is optimal chemical taste soda. Like you absolutely taste the
chemical. You like chemicals? I got facts for you.
You definitely taste the chemical, but it tastes great. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead. Right,
here we go. They're still good, not expired. They're going to last till next Easter. Let's try these.
You've tried them before or no?
No.
Okay. You've tried other flavored Peeps?
Peeps to me are just...
They're like, just there's no flavor? Yeah, there's only there's one flavor?
No flavor.
The flavor is the texture?
Yeah, we're going to find out.
Yeah.
You get a whole tray to yourself.
This really does make me think of industrial chicken practices. I don't like it.
This reminds you of eating KFC.
Yeah, this is not good. Ooh.
They're a funny color. They're Dr. Pepper-ish color.
But like, it's not encouraging that it's still just straight white on the inside. So the coating is Dr. Pepper?
Yeah, and the rest is marshmallow.
Smells like Dr. Pepper.
Mm-hmm. So bubbly. It almost tastes carbonated.
That's interesting. Yeah, no, you're not wrong.
It's better than a regular Peep.
Yeah, regular Peeps are not good. My main takeaway from this is if you are able to create essentially sprinkled on Dr. Pepper, I would like to have that in like a spice pot, like what you would get like garlic powder in or onion powder. Can I just get this sprinkled on Dr. Pepper in a bottle like that to add it to like ice cream or something?
Yeah, is that the first thing you would put it on, like vanilla ice cream?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. These are good.
You're a sicko.
This is low-key not bad.
Yeah.
Way better than I thought. My expectations were low. I see why they did this. I don't know why, really, but whoever figured it out and was like, no, I swear it's going to work, was not wrong.
It's a 6.
I was going to say 6.5.
Oh, so you, but you'd like it though. You sure saw it?
Yeah, but
I
thought it was going to be like in the ones.
Yeah, it's
a peep maxes out at 6.5.
Can someone literally just send me a bottle or a sachet of the sprinkled on
dehydrated
crystalline Dr.
Pepper.
Yes. Pepper?
Yeah.
That I'd be curious to have. If you're the food scientist or whatever the company that makes Dr. Pepper is.
Tastes like Dr. Pepper.
It absolutely tastes like Dr. Pepper. Ah, the texture. I hate the texture.
I mean, artificial marshmallow, like, you know, it's a tough sell.
I hate the texture, but I will say, like, recently, I was probably off of TikTok. I saw some doctor be like,
Some doctor.
Say that if you have a really bad cough, which, you know, if you have COVID or you have any other bronchial thing, that the gelatin in marshmallow, if you chew it, can coat your throat and make it a little less.
We can't verify
this. I mean, I tried it. Not bad.
Try honey. It's made by God's creatures.
That is our show. Every podcast ever is at nytimes.com/podcast. Podcast Deluxe. Lil Jon interview, Girl in Red interview, us talking about meta discourse, all of that in these chairs, youtube.com/podcast, like and subscribe. Email us for the upcoming mailbag episode. That's podcast@nytimes.com and subscribe to podcast anywhere you get your audio or audio visual content. That is Spotify, Apple, YouTube, and beyond. Our senior producer is Sawyer Roque. Our editor is Jamie Heffitz. Special thanks to Leslie Davis, Pat Gunther, Nell Galogli, Neil Lossom, Karen Gans, Pedro Rosado. We'll be back next week.